Well, greetings from the studio. We're live in the studio tonight in my time, and you're listening to this whenever you're listening to this, probably Monday morning, maybe, podcast 556. We're going to define freedom, or at least begin the process of defining freedom in this podcast 556. Now, before I start talking about sovereignty, personal freedom, and defining freedom and stuff like that, I want to mention very quickly Hydrus. I love Hydrus. HydrusPerformance.com. This is the website where you get the information on this sports drink. And I have really spent a lot of time talking about the value of Hydrus in terms of you know, some of the more athletic pursuits, whether it's strongman competitions or CrossFit or power yoga, you know, where you're doing yoga in these rooms where it's really hot. And I do it every day, sometimes twice a day. And it really has transformed my yoga practice. And I don't want to, you know, first of all, it does invigorate your mind and body. I am practicing with drinking a lot of it because it really changes. I believe it has an effect on the mind. And it's because the mind, you know, your body is water, your brain is sitting there in water. And if you drink a lot of, you get yourself hydrated and you get electrolytes into your system, maybe it has an effect on the way that you think as well. But then some people have said that they started drinking Hydrus and it affected and improved the situation where they were tired or they were cramped. And people don't realize that they get dehydrated. And that's one of the things that causes this, especially cramping and being tired. And it used to be with me when I would do yoga, it would be painful. And I'll tell you what, very quickly, I had an experience with that this week because I took a 4 or 5 day break when I went up to AgoraFest and I wasn't drinking Hydrus there and I came back, except I did have one thing of Hydrus. But what happens is it washes out, right? It has to build up. And I did yoga. I went back to yoga hardcore and I was really sore. And I was like, why am I so? It took me a few days to realize, well, the reason you're sore is that Hydrus has not been built up in your system. So if you're a construction worker, you're an athlete, or you're a mom with a headache, believe it or not, especially people who are over 55 later in the afternoon, they'll say that they're tired or that they have a headache. If you take Hydrus, if you use Hydrus properly, you can address that. And it's better, it's better than actually drinking something like 5-hour energy. Even young people, they'll drink 5-hour energy, which is basically caffeine. And there's nothing wrong. I mean, if you want to drink that stuff, that's fine. And I really shouldn't mention 5-hour energy in the spot, but I will. You can drink that stuff. But the thing is with Hydrus, what you're doing is you're addressing the real problem, which is dehydration most of the time. I think also that you'd be surprised that Hydrus can be kind of a complement to those drinks as opposed to a competitor with those drinks because it addresses the electrolyte water balance. All right, without going on any further, if you want more information about Hydrus or you want to order some, I highly recommend it regardless of what you're doing. Hydrus is a new high-performance beverage that uses exclusive nanosome technology to get critical electrolytes into your system with unrivaled speed and effectiveness. You get it at HydrusPerformance.com, HYDRUS, Hydrus Performance. Performance.com. That's HydrusPerformance.com. So this is one of the things that I've been thinking about, and I filled in on the Patriot today, and I kind of did this in 4 segments on the Patriot. So if you want to go to the website there and listen to the show, you can. But I'm going to do a little bit more in podcast format because I spent a fair amount of time at the beginning talking about, you know, I'm a podcaster and, you know, I'm doing this show and I try to explain the Bob Davis podcast radio show and the difference between paid programming on radio and blah, 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 blah. I don't need to do that in this podcast format. Basically, I had to go through this whole explanation of why I don't take calls on the radio. And I don't think we need to. I've certainly talked about that a few times. We don't need to do that. But one of the things I did say that I think is true is that probably one of the biggest problems in this society is, in terms of the discourse, is everybody talking and not enough listening and not enough reading of source material. And I didn't actually write that. I actually came up with that. Source material meaning, you know, not some guy's book that he wrote that they hand out at BPOU meetings for the Republicans and Tea Party meetings or something that's self-published. But, you know, real source material, real history books, you know, real economics books from people like von Mises or Adam Smith, books like The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire by Gibbon, the Bible, you know, stuff like that. And what you end up with is a lot of debate and arguing that really is ideas and concepts and thoughts are encapsulated in people's minds because they are watching these endless, you know, green screen debates between people on network and cable television and round tables and everyone shouting and in my opinion, shouting, even if they aren't, you know, everybody going back and forth. And most of the time, the discussion isn't substantive. Well, what do I mean by that? Why isn't the conversation substantive? It's not substantive because they're not talking about substantive things. They're not defining freedom. They're not talking about, coercive government programs, or they're not talking about, you know, taxation in the sense that we're talking about, you know, taxation and what it basically takes from the economy, things of that nature. We're talking about whether or not for the 15th time, for the 15th millionth time, we're talking about Hillary Clinton's emails, or we're talking about whether or not Donald Trump called somebody a pig, or we're talking about whatever. These are not substantive conversations. These are ratings getting, meter getting, capturing, clickbait debates, quote unquote, that really don't mean anything. And you don't learn anything watching that. And you don't learn anything even going online and looking at the internet and just doing a scan of articles, because what you get in the articles is you get, for example, today, this is Sunday. We're still, rehashing the last debate between between Senator Clinton and our former Secretary Clinton and Donald Trump. And it's all about the federal taxes. And the New York Times didn't play federal tax. And, is this right or is this wrong? And then you've got the Bobos on the Trump side, you know, trying to defend him. And you got the Bobos on the Clinton side trying to defend her. And it's just, you know, it's not substantive. So if you use social media, if you listen to the radio, if you watch television, you know, you are essentially told over and over and over again what they think you want to hear and what they want to put in your head. And then what do the politicians do? The politicians go out and they surf this. They go out and they talk about, you know, isn't it terrible that Donald Trump is one of these rich guys that doesn't pay federal taxes, and, you know, as though no one else fills out a tax return and as though no one else takes whatever deduction they can get for whatever they can get it for, because that's the nature of the beast. We take all of your money and then we give you a little bit back and we do wonderful things with your money, or we take your money and we don't give it back to you, period. So one of the reasons I love podcasting is that as a medium, you can get into substantive discussions. It isn't a two-way discussion. You don't take calls. You don't have to have a round table. You don't have to have arguing back and forth. And you don't have to put up with memes and, you know, staring at a TV channel that goes on and on and on and doesn't, in the end, accomplish anything left. And all it's based on is this idea of the left-right political continuum and the current two-party system, which, as I have said on numerous occasions, is breaking down. I think the two-party system in the United States is breaking down, and I've talked about this and talked about this and talked about this. I probably should have said this at the beginning, but the basis of this thing that I did on the radio, which honestly, I don't think anybody heard because think that they were listening, but it's this idea that there really is no liberty movement in America, and I repeated it, and I'm going to repeat it again and again. Despite what people believe, there is no liberty movement in America. Oh yes, there's people going to Tea Party meetings, and there are people making angry posts on social media, and there are people calling the talk radio station. But when it comes to creating organizations that generate money and votes for causes or candidates, building real movements that intimidate politicians, there's no liberty movement. And I think if the truth was actually known in terms of raw numbers, I think people would be, especially people within the so-called liberty movement, they would be shocked to actually see the demographics and actually see that the numbers really aren't very high at all in comparison to the rest of the population. And it is steeped in old thinking when it comes to how to build organizations, and it is steeped in old thinking when it comes to what media is important and what isn't. Almost all the people in these meetings and in these movements watch cable television news. Nobody who really knows anything wastes their time with that anymore. Almost all these people listen to talk radio. Nobody who knows anything wastes their time with that anymore. either. And, you know, what ends up happening is that the politicians who claim to be quote unquote conservative continue to co-opt these movements by simply spending money to promote their own points of view, buy their own commercials. And where do they get the money? They get the money from the people who are moderate Republicans. They get the money from the people who are one issue Charlies, whether it's abortion or whether it's you pick a poison, Second Amendment or whatever it is, and it's really a dying movement in general. And then you get the pundits that are the paid spokesperson and the bobos who go out and basically shill for a movement in order to sell books and get opportunities to speak in front of these groups. And it's all about co-opting these groups. So there is no liberty movement in this country. And I told the story today of a good friend of mine who's running for office, and we were talking about things that you could do in terms of door knocking. And that there are ways to generate votes through door knocking. And one of the things that came up was, well, we tried that and we had a bunch of signs that we wanted to put up. And we asked for volunteers to show up, and the day came to put the signs up and go door to door and tell people your sign is here and we're going to put it up. And the fact is that there were three people there. One was one of the BPOU officers. The other was the candidate, and the third was just somebody who was trying to help. And that was the extent of their volunteer staff. And this happens again and again and again in House races in Minnesota. It happens again and again in congressional races, especially tough congressional races and state representative races and state senate races and local township races for people running for office trying to do something, because there is no movement behind the rhetoric. There's just people who are really angry when it comes to something that happened. It's usually about the UN or Agenda 21 or Hillary Clinton's emails, or, you know, that the debate was rigged because that's what it says, you know, on this channel that I watch, and so forth and so on. And none of it's doing anything. So there isn't any organization that actually promotes, liberty. And what we're watching is we're watching a presidential campaign that's testing this theory that a personality can generate votes with rhetoric, and I don't believe that's possible. Could it happen? Yes, but I doubt it. And I don't need to go into the state-by-state polls, because you have two other podcasts you can listen to along those lines. But if you look at the state-by-state polls, you're going to find that what generates votes is organizations. It's organizations that raise enough money to buy commercials for congressional candidates. It's organizations that have enough money to, get people out on the street to door knock. It's organizations that can figure out how to get, yard signs to people, and that can figure out how to get people to show up for rallies and so on and so on. That's the actual, retail politics. That's what makes the world go round. It's not, people who go out and say bombastic things. So, and one of the things I'll probably talk about a little bit in the future is, the demographics of the so-called liberty movement, which are really abysmal. They're 55 plus at best. And these people are not going to, they don't have the energy to lead the quote-unquote revolution. So, I guess I would ask, given the two-party system, who are the liberty candidates? What is the Liberty Party? It certainly isn't the Republicans. It isn't the Democrats. We know that. The Democrats believe government is a great force for good in our society. Now, if you agree with that, great. I mean, some people do. I don't. But some people do. But the Republican Party is supposed to be for limited government. It's supposed to be for, the certain values. And limited government seems to be the one that comes up again and again and again. But Republicans don't limit the government. They just keep building on what we have. And they keep talking about, for example, Mr. Trump consistently emphasizes, tax breaks for daycare. So again, we're going to take your money at the point of a gun. We're going to coerce your money from you for your own good. And then we're going to give you a little bit of it back so you can feel better about us. That's not liberty, in my view. That is not, that's not limited government. That's just making the government the sovereign. And I think that's the core of the discussion. And, we talk about the Declaration of Independence. People go to meetings. They talk about the U.S. Constitution. They study the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence. They can tell you that Jefferson said this, and Monroe said this, and Hamilton did that, and Washington, yada, yada, yada. But just because you attend a meeting somewhere and someone says it's why, because it's in the Declaration of Independence or it's in the U.S. Constitution, that doesn't mean that there is a liberty movement. So the real question is, what does freedom mean to you? Is it economic freedom? Is it social freedom? Is it personal freedom? Because there is a left-right political continuum, right? And personal freedom to someone on the far left is perhaps completely different from personal freedom on the far right. So I think defining freedom starts not with the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence. It starts with this question of sovereignty, and I'm going to be talking about that a lot in the near future, because the fact is that all representative government, and really almost all government in history, but let's just start with the Athenians, all the way up to the United States, have struggled with this question of sovereignty. Does the sovereign reside in the king? Is it something in his ring that he uses to seal his decrees? Does the sovereign reside in the parliament, which represents the people in some way, shape, or form? Which in the British rendition of this was nobility, or in the Venetian, the Republic of Venice was interlocking councils. Is it a demigod like the Japanese emperor, or a nation? And so we say the sovereign resides in the national sash that the president wears when he's inaugurated in some countries. Or is it a party like the Communist Party in the USSR, or formerly the USSR, or the current Chinese government? Or is it something where we say, well, the sovereignty resides with we, the people, which, by the way, is also a collective by some people's reading. So it's the people of the country, or it's the nation. The flag represents the sovereign. It represents the sovereignty of the United States and the quote-unquote sovereignty of the United States. I think the sovereign is the individual, and I think we're missing this point really strongly in our society. I think individual sovereignty precedes the Constitution. It supersedes the Constitution. It precedes the Declaration of Independence and all of our founding documents, and supersedes those documents. And I think we need to start talking about what we think personal sovereignty actually means, because I think what it means is all of us individually, not collectively, but all of us individually are in fact the state, and the state is supposed to be subservient to all of us individually. And that means that our individual wishes, do I want to start a business? Do I want to own a certain kind of firearm? Do I want to do something in my backyard? As long as I am not hurting someone else next door, or hurting someone as in committing, you know, a crime. And I don't mean a crime of opinion, but a crime, you know, such as murdering someone or whatever. I'm talking about, you know, Ten Commandments type of crime, basically. The state should be subservient to our wishes, but we don't live in a country where we have that. So if individual sovereignty means our individual freedom, as in our ability to have what we want when we want to have it with some reasonable, perhaps, caveats, that has to come first. And I just don't think we're living in that kind of a state. I mean, I suppose I should ask the question, are we living in that kind of a state? I don't think we are. And I don't think we're living in that kind of a state nationally. And I don't think we're living in that kind of a state locally in terms of the state of Minnesota or the state of Wyoming or wherever you live. We all pay high taxes, and we have to pay them. And if we don't pay them, you know, we'll go to jail. We all have regulations we absolutely have to obey. We have heavy security at the airports, and that's soon going to be extended to bus stations and train stations. We have expensive, not efficient government services for all kinds of things. And I mentioned today this article that came out in the Sunday papers about how the Minnesota health exchanges, which, remember, they were creating a market. The government was deigning to create a market for insurance in the state of Minnesota, not health care, but health insurance. And of course, the insurance companies are put in a position where they can't, they're not able to function with these markets that have been walled off, supposedly. So now they want to raise their rates, and we're looking at rate increases of 50% and 60% and 70%, and it's people are furious over this. And this was given to you by your state government. Thank you, Jim Abler, a state senator who just thought it was great that we have MnSure and thinks it's funny when everyone argues with him. He thinks it's just a big joke, apparently. All kinds of coercion going on with unelected boards, from the Federal Reserve to the Met Council, making decisions about what our resources go to. We're going to build roundabouts because we're going to get this federal money and we don't want to turn down the federal money. So we want to put roundabouts in your town. Well, if you don't want them, then you're turning down the federal money. Nobody seems to understand it comes from the same wallet. It's all the same money. It's being coerced from you in order to do things they think are good for you. So again, it's this example that people in the government view the government as the sovereign, not you. You're just a subject of this this wide swath of government interlocking boards, which are unelected, that do things that they want to do, making decisions about us and our lives. And what it amounts to is government impinging on the rights of the individual. So this question of sovereignty becomes really, really important. Is the government sovereign? Is the government sovereign, or is the individual sovereign? I say the individual sovereign, and that the government should be bent to our will and not the other way around. So when people say, well, okay, yeah, I kind of agree with that. You know, if you're a liberty person, you're probably going to agree with that, which is great. How do we fix that? How do we make that happen? And I have come to the conclusion that in order to fix that, we, meetings on Thursdays or Wednesdays or Tuesdays aren't going to do it. An ancillary group to discuss these things isn't going to do it. We need new political parties in this country, and in particular on the right, if such a thing exists anymore. And I don't believe that it does. And I even hate using this continuum that we've come to know as the left-right political continuum, because it really represents the two-party system that is dying in this country. We need a new political party to take back our sovereignty, and the Republicans are not going to do it. And I've come down really hard on them. I don't care whether it's Minnesota's GOP or certain congressmen from different states. They're not going to do it because they don't feel any pressure to do it. They're going to do just exactly what they're told, because most of these congressmen are just bobos. They're not going to go to Washington to fight to return your sovereignty to you from the government. And when I talk about this, I mean that they need to permanently to have the power to have the sovereign over you permanently removed, which means in the case of the Met Council needs to be permanently removed. Well, how do you do that? Well, you have to elect a legislature and a governor that's going to permanently change the statutes so that sovereign individuals and towns and cities can say no to the Met Council. And you cut their budget and you take their police force away from them, and you cut the salaries of the people who sit on that council to $30,000 or $20,000 so that it actually is a service. And when you do that, then they will be bent to the will of the people. And of course, there'll be circumstances that will result from that, but we will be free of their will. That's what has to happen. Well, how do you do that? You think the Republicans are going to actually do something about the Met Council? They're not going to do anything about the Met Council. You know, they're going to change they've done what they've already done, which is they're going to change the length of the terms, and they're going to stagger who gets appointed and when and all this other nonsense. Or they're going to say, well, maybe we should have these people run. Let's make it an elected body. Well, you don't want that, because now you're going to have a third, central government in the region. So now you have county governments, you have city governments, you have state governments, and now you're going to have this junta, which is known as the Met Council. So what has to happen is, their power to do these things needs to be permanently removed. The power of Congress and the presidency to do certain things needs to be permanently removed. That is not going to happen with Republicans or Democrats. It's going to have to happen with a new political party in this country. So one of the things I talk about a lot, and I'm not going to spend too much time talking about it now, but we've had five, roughly five, perhaps six party systems in the United States. The first one, of course, was the Federalists and the Republicans, and this was Alexander Hamilton and Thomas Jefferson. The Federalists believed that we needed to have a strong central government to provide centralized banking and services to the elite Northeastern merchants, and Southerners like Thomas Jefferson believed that we needed to have a more agrarian, loosely based Confederacy and opposed a strong central government until, of course, he became president. And then by fiat, he signed Louisiana Purchase. Then we had the second party system from 1828 to 1854. This is, of course, the Jacksonian Democrats, led by Andrew Jackson, against the Whig Party, led by Henry Clay. The Democrats believed in a strong executive branch. Remember that, you know, people talk about Jefferson as the, I guess, both the father of the Republican Party and the father of the Democrat Party, because it was the Democratic Republicans or something. I don't remember. And, you know, here we have the Democrats strongly advocating for a strong executive branch, but at the same time, a more populist agenda opposing the Bank of the United States and infrastructure development, benefiting, again, the Northeast at the expense of the so-called common man, the Davy Crockett type guy in the hills of West Virginia, or what eventually would become West Virginia. The Whigs believed in the primacy of Congress and the policies of modernization, and they were economic protectionists. And this is, you know, again, this is one of the proto-Republican elements. It's just interesting how these parties have flipped different times throughout the system. The third party system was 1854 through the 1890s. This was the anti-slavery Republican Party, which adopted the economic policy of the Whigs. The Democrats originally were supporters of slavery and slave states, and included this coalition of Southerners, traditional businessmen in the North, and Catholic immigrants. So again, you see a flipping of the political spectrum. The fourth party system was a progressive era, which here again was dominated by Republicans. We talk about progressives today as being Democrats, but Teddy Roosevelt was the first progressive, and this is where we started to regulate the railroads and the tariffs and trust busting and unions and child labor and the need for a new banking system in this country, which eventually resulted in the Federal Reserve and so on and so on. Then the fifth party system, which some academics believe was 1933 to the present. Others believe we actually are on the sixth party system, which was the Reagan Revolution. This is the New Deal that started with the Democrats in the 1930s, with the opposition really being a minority of Taft Republicans who were trade protectionists, moderate Republicans from the Northeast. And, you know, that kind of became the so-called Rockefeller wing of the Republican Party. And this is where you get these debates about Ronald Reagan being a Western politician, being the sixth party system. I don't know, but I can tell you that what has happened is the political parties in this country have gotten ahead of the people. They've gotten behind the people. I always screw that up. They've gotten behind the people, and the people, without knowing it, I think because we're on the cusp of an incredible revolution in industry and technology. We're talking about robotics. We're talking about new ways to communicate. We're talking about artificial intelligence. We're talking about plants that make things that human beings do not have anything to do with, including cars. We're talking about IT up the yin yang. We're talking about this incredible thing that you have called the smartphone, which is more powerful than any computer. You know, literally not much more than 10 years ago. 15, 20 years ago, and we're on the cusp of an incredible change in our social structure, in our industrial structure, in our economic structures, whether it's fusion power, driverless cars, robotic production, as I mentioned, interstellar space travel, which is going to happen, a revolution in communications, revolution in society, leisure time, and the ability to magnify your skills to time shift and to be more productive through technology. This is an ongoing thing. And yet we have an education system which is designed to produce workers, middle managers, and gray flannel executives that we needed to have in the 1950s, but we do not need to have in the 2050s. You know, we have a situation where almost all government services are really from the 1950s. Even the models that they use at the Commerce Department are basically mathematic models developed in the 1950s. We are just in the process of updating the radar systems at most major airports, which were developed in the 1950s. So we are dealing with all this industrial crap you know, from literally almost 100 years ago. It's 20, you know, it's soon to be 2020, people. So you're dealing with something that, that was really preeminent 70 years ago, and our government is not keeping up. So we have to have new political parties because both political parties are using old thinking in spades. Well, we can fix this, but we can't get rid of that. We can't do this, and we don't want to do this. And they keep pointing to the Constitution, both sides of the political spectrum, as justification to do this, that, or the other thing. And we have to take our sovereignty back and say, look, we're going to have a government that addresses the things because I want all this stuff. You know, I want this stuff faster, and I want this stuff better. I want, you know, I want companies that can produce, sorry, I hit that thing again, produce fiber optic, you know, glass cable, faster, cheaper internet. I want, you know, I want Wi-Fi everywhere. I want to be able to go and order up on the online a car and have it come to my house and take me wherever I want. I want to be able to, you know, have a car made or to have something made that I want in the colors that I want, how I want, and I want to have it made by machines and delivered to my house within 15 hours. I mean, I want stuff like that. I want better food. I want, you know, I want. And guess what? The government's not going to provide that. The only thing that can provide that are free markets. Truly free markets, not a controlled market economy where you've got the government impinging on the markets, but truly free markets where value is assessed and you know, comparative advantage rules, and people who are inventive and creative are able to succeed rapidly. So we don't have that. And top to bottom, the whole system is not working. So when you actually start defining your sovereignty, defining what you consider to be freedom, real freedom, we're living through a time that has these great contrasts between true freedom giving, liberty giving technology, and the government that's left that keeps reaching out with its, you know, like a zombie's hand. And reaching out of the grave and grabbing hold of your foot and trying to pull you back down. And it isn't the politician's fault because they don't know any better. And it isn't the businessmen's fault because they're just trying to get by. And it isn't the system. It's our fault because we need to go out and say, A, what are the steps to creating a political movement? B, what are the steps to creating a viable political party? C, what are the steps to creating a viable political party that attracts young people and that attracts, you know, wide swaths of the population, that creates a real movement that puts the fear of God into politicians to the extent that they have to join this new party and become, you know, our servants? And those are the questions that I think we should be asking. So when you hear people talking about liberty movements, they're just talking about words because they don't understand that we are so far from creating a movement. They can't even get local people elected, let alone create a political movement that generates enough votes and money to really scare these politicians who in the end are just going to do what they're told by somebody who has a lot of money. So that's what I was thinking about this weekend. I almost fell off my chair. And I just wanted to get that down in podcast form because I had such a good time doing that on the radio today that I just thought I'd throw it down as a podcast and put it up for you today without the interruptions and without the whole radio patina. And I like the radio thing. I mean, it's fun to be forced into, you know, specific break times and to have to think in those ways. That's great. But podcasting enables you to do things that you could not do on the radio. And it's becoming clear to me that I am a podcaster. And I am a podcaster far more than I am a radio guy, because I don't even think anybody heard what I did. Or if they did, they were just like, this is just too, I can't deal with this. I tuned in to find out what was going on with the Ryder Cup, and I've got this giant thing, this giant piece of protein that I can't possibly digest. So now you can listen to this, stop it, go get a cup of coffee or something, and then come back and listen to it again. So thanks for listening to podcast. What is this? Podcast 556. How do you define freedom? Now, I'm not going to, I went on way too long at the beginning with Hydrus, so I'm not going to go crazy with it again, but I am going to mention, if you want to try Hydrus, I really think you should. H-Y-D-R-U-S, Hydrus Performance. This is going to help you with all these dehydration issues, whether you are doing CrossFit or Strongman or Yoga Sculpt or any of that stuff, or if you're a construction worker, or if you are experiencing fatigue late in the afternoon, or experiencing, you know, headaches, especially if you're over 55, Hydrus can help with this if you use it properly. And all the information about how to do that is at hydrusperformance.com. That's H-Y-D-R-U-S, hydrusperformance.com. Now, one more thing before I go. I am going to be heading out on the big Western trip in Mobile Podcast Command after a few things this coming week. And I'm not quite sure what day I'm going to go, but I'm rolling to Seattle via, I've decided I'm going to go the northern route and roll out to Seattle through Glacier National, which I haven't been to in probably 10, maybe even 20 years. And then, of course, Seattle. And then down from Seattle to Los Angeles by way of Napa Valley and my favorite restaurant in the world, the Nepenthe. And Los Angeles, and then over to Phoenix and back up to the Twin Cities. This is a little section of the world, especially the Northwest part, that I have not yet covered. So that leaves one, after this trip, that's one section, and that's New England that I haven't been to, and that's going to get scratched off the list in the next summer. So I've got some things I want to look into heading out, and I'm going to need contributions for Mobile Podcast Command, and specifically for Diesel. So as I head out, I'm going to do a podcast, of course, once I get out there, thanking people who've contributed. And I do appreciate the people that are dumping money into Mobile Podcast Command via the PayPal account there on the page at the bobdavispodcast.com. You look for the picture of Mobile Podcast Command. Just underneath that is a big yellow donate button. You click on that and then you can make a donation. And I don't care if it's a dollar. It really helps. You know, I can always buy beef jerky with a couple of dollars. But if you do want to put more money in there than that, you can't believe how much I appreciate it. In fact, John Holland, who gave me a big contribution specifically for wheel simulators, would be pleased to know that I've just purchased brand new wheel simulators. They're on the truck and they look great. So thanks, John. So yeah, it goes right to Mobile Podcast Command. And thanks for your donations at thebobdavispodcast.com. Thanks for listening to the audio stream continuously at thebobdavispodcast.com and liking and sharing and favoriting on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and all that stuff. And as I mentioned, the donations, thanks for listening on Stitcher.com, iTunes, TuneIn, blogtalkradio.com, The Patriot for the Bob Davis Podcast radio show. And that's it. I don't have anything else to say. This is kind of a weird motor mouth, high speed, super dense podcast. What is that? What do we call that? But I'm going to, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to drink my coffee and I'm going to watch some Netflix now for the next few hours. And then I'm going to go to bed. So thanks for listening to the podcast 556.